very good morning now, though, to Trish Sherson in the Auckland studio. Good morning, Trish.
Good morning, Catherine.
And good morning, Stephen Wills in the Wellington, Mills in the Wellington studio.
Morning, Catherine.
Stephen's Executive Director of UMR Research, former political advisor to two Labor governments. Trish is from corporate affairs firm Sherson Willis and a former ACT press secretary. Let's begin. I was just going to say the ACT leader's probably had his biggest moment with the referendum now on and the bill on assisted dying getting the vote in Parliament. But let's come back to the referenda plural a little later. Let's start with the Greens. There's been a lot of reflection on the zero carbon bill. Much of us talking about Labor, I suppose, and the coalition getting this through and picking up the support of most of the Parliament as they do it. Contemplation on whether this is a double-edged sword for the Greens. How do you see things, Stephen?
I completely disagree. I think you could hardly get more compelling evidence of the value of having the Greens in Parliament and indeed of having James Shaw as the leader of the Greens. I think it's an amazing achievement to negotiate this through. I think in time this will prove to be the most important piece of legislation this government passes. I mean, as I sort of talked about before, I think democracy's completely failed over the last sort of 10 years or so to deal with any sort of tough long-term issue. If there's any voters who are kind of missing out or losing because of reforms necessary or a vested interest that's affected, and in climate change you've got both those tests, democracy's incapable of dealing with it. So I think having this independent commission, even if it doesn't have Reserve Bank powers, I think that has to be the way forward. And I think in time there will be. I mean, if the scientists are right, and being an historian, I have no reason to doubt that scientists are right, there will be a tipping point. It will become clear to people that this isn't any sort of abstract thing, but affecting people's lives directly. And at that point, I think it will be very difficult for any government not to implement the recommendations of that commission.
Is that not the point of the criticism in some ways, though, that if the division had remained, if National had stayed outside of the tent here, others had stayed outside of the tent here, that very precise case and staking out of ground would have been, or New Zealand First for that matter, would have been left open to Labor and the Greens, whereas now that staking out of ground is everybody's. Trish, how do you see it?
I agree with Stephen, actually. I mean, I think there's three important points. Number one, for New Zealand, with the passing of this bill, not only have we become a leader, but at a time of incredibly divisive politics around the world where a lot of countries, and the US is a great example, are unable actually to get any sort of political consensus on big issues and move things through. I think that it is a win for the Parliament that there was consensus. I think around a piece of critical legislation like this, you do want a consensus. I also think it's a time for the Green Party to reflect that after so many years in Parliament, not only have they had a leader who has got them into government, but in government actually, as Stephen said, been able to enact one of the most important pieces of legislation for this government. I think it is a massive achievement for them. I think at the end of the day, this will be seen as a victory for James Shaw as a leader of the Greens. I think he has worked so hard across the Parliament and also got kudos from a range of commentators and media on this bill that there is the opportunity for the Greens to, take their reputation and credibility further than it has ever been, both in a parliamentary sense and in a public sense, potentially.
Here's the thing, Trish, and this has always been the issue with the Greens. There's the credibility factor, right? But there you've got Gareth Hughes announcing he's not standing again next year and saying the government is not linking the two directly, but saying the government is not transformational in the sense that transformational means in the dictionary. Because here we are, we've got the framework now, but we've still had emissions that plateaued and then I think started rising again. It's all very well to have achieved the bureaucratic and symbolic passing of the Act, but the really hard stuff is still to come.
It still needs a change in public opinion.
Well, there's two points there. One is, I would say, Gareth Hughes is leaving Parliament after 10 years with not many runs on the board, to be honest. And I think there you have a good the difference, I would say, between, you know, a Green Party who wants to be essentially an activist NGO or a Green Party who wants to be a mainstream political party and really wants to achieve change. But your second point is the important one. Yes, now we've got a framework which is a step forward, but the really hard work now begins to try and lower our emissions using that framework, and that is a very big and hard journey. What makes me feel optimistic around that, though, is the consensus wasn't just across Parliament, but you also had important groups like the Climate Leaders Coalition, which is the biggest and broadest base of companies who have signed up, who also called for this bill to be passed and for all parties to support it. So I think along the journey, you have also gathered in the business community. I also think that, you know, the farming community is more on the side of this than some of the edge groups around farming would have you believe. I mean, I think even though farmers are an ageing population, on the whole, they are probably also looking across the ditch to their Australian counterparts and going, you know, we now have the opportunity to protect this industry, to take it forward, and to work with a range of businesses to help New Zealand get ahead of this.
Can I just say, because I don't think the politics of this is over at all. I think National would have been very pleased with the media reception to their vote on the zero carbon bill, and I think they got a lot of pretty undeserved credit, actually. I think they're still in the position of following that famous prayer, Lord, make me pure, but not yet. They've signalled that they'll make changes to the methane target, and I think that sends a broader signal that if you're aggrieved about anything, that National will still kind of listen to you and possibly implement what you want. I think they have to defend their record, which every change that's been made, the oil and gas exploration, their rhetoric on that was apocalyptic. They ran a very aggressive campaign against the fee bait policy, which seemed to me a very easy one for them to support and probably sensible for them to have done so. They basically had a dishonest social media campaign attacking that. In both those cases, I think they're more or less pledged to reverse things, and if that's clarified in an election campaign, they're not going to look pretty, they're not going to look good at all. And I think we're still, I think progress has certainly been made, but I think in the short term, until public opinion does kind of reach that tipping point, which it may be doing in Australia, which is worth a discussion, I think anyone who wants serious action on climate change is still going to vote Greens or Labor, and anybody who's a profound sceptic is still going to vote ACT or
it's
National.
It's interesting. We've had that conversation previously, though, the difference between your sort of knee-jerk reaction to things and what actually turns up in your policy, and the context for that discussion was around things like, the immunisation, not getting your benefit if you don't immunise, or as Chris Luxon walked, Christopher, now Chris, I don't know, I'll sort that out.
Give him a break, it's now, Chris now.
Apparently, retail name.
Chris Luxon then, you know, got dragged into taking it further. So you say things in the moment to speak to a certain audience. The question is how much of this actually turns up in their policy, and they will be measuring how the wind turns. Stephen, you've just been in Australia. We did an interview. It actually stopped me in my tracks, the Friday one, with a risk reduction expert, an Australian who's been at the UN for 10 years doing all sorts of risk analysis around the world. He's come home and written such a blunt report about the now and the near future. And it's things like the combo of the extended droughts, then you've got cyclone seasons that are ramping up on top of the already bare ground, the fire season extending in different directions, the exhaustion this causes.
Just meant to be beginning
it's,
now.
It's just, you know, a little bit on already kind of fragile balances in a very harsh country, climate-wise anyway, let's admit. And his warnings are just so stark. It's like planning now to relocate communities now. And is that seeping in? There was such a furious political reaction to the talk during the fires about climate change, but is that what you sensed over there?
Well, one political scientist said that these fires are a match under the climate change issue, and I was involved in a lot of discussions with people, you know, in my circles, left circles, when I was over there meeting, you know, people from the ALP, that maybe this is going to be a turning point. I suspect it won't be, but I think it's a step towards a turning point. It is just amazing. I mean, that interview was incredible, but, you know, like the points that are being made there, like the wetlands are burning and they used to act as natural fire breaks. And what sort of struck me and gave me pause for thought that maybe the world is moving a little bit was 24 retired fire chiefs came out and they'd been trying to talk to Scott Morrison about the threat imposed by climate change, you know, on their resources and capacity to deal with fires. And he'd kind of been refusing to see them, which wasn't a good look as things turned out. And they delivered an absolutely, these are real kind of Aussie blokes delivering a straight to the camera message, where their message, you know, it wasn't any different from Greta Thunberg or the Greens, really, that climate change is happening. It's really serious and action needs to be taken. And the points they made, so don't have the resources to deal with an extended fire season. And also that the scale and ferocity of the fires means that, the techniques they've used to survive are putting firefighters' lives at risk.
As Robert Glasser said, the old instruction about stay and fight now is just basically gone as well to homeowners over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. I've never really understood that. I'd flee fast. But there was a vicious kind of fight at the fringes of Australian politics where the National Party just said crazy things. Their leader, who normally doesn't say anything, Mark McCormick, and of course Barnaby Joyce chimed in with a very weird statement saying that two of the people who died in the fires were Green voters, so he wasn't going to criticise them with the implication that he would otherwise. And the main party's kind of stayed out of that, but you could see the kind of political temperature really rising on it.
Just staying with the Greens here, the other thing that popped out last week was this leaked discussion document. I think this popped up in the Herald, if that serves me rightly, that they're getting ready to pull support for the spending limits, the government's self-imposed spending limits. Well, I don't think that's going to upset Labor any, is it? If it's thinking smart, it might be contemplating doing that itself in its longer-term planning. What do you make of that, Trish?
Yeah, I don't think Labor would be worried about that. I mean, I think one of the big pressures coming around that self-imposed cap is actually, I think, what's going to be a big debate next year, and that is around infrastructure funding. And if you really want to get a serious handle on not only the gap we've got in infrastructure, but being able to do some smart things to try and get us ahead of that, I think removing that cap is important. And probably for Labor, it's almost like trying to take the trainer wheels off. So I think they impose those caps as a way of saying, particularly to the business community and the market, hey, we're really responsible. But if you have a strong message to those audiences about why you're taking the cap off, and importantly, what you need that additional headroom for, I think that would actually go down quite well.
I mean, I think that $7.5 billion surplus, which is exaggerated because there's been some accounting changes, right, but it's still a whopper of a surplus.
Unlikely to be sustained, though.
I don't know what happened to the 11 billion dollar hole, but unlikely to be sustained. I think the other really important thing to point out is the difference between the operational surplus and the capital spending that you would use for big infrastructure projects. They are different strands of funding, and it's the latter where you might be looking at loosening those debt limits and doing some borrowing, Trish.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting, isn't it? What I'm wondering about in the lead up to this election is kind of how the sentiment has shifted. If you think in the lead up to the last election, a lot of the sentiment was because of the coalescence around Jacinda and her sort of messaging around what we can do for other people. Essentially, I wonder how that has now moved in the electorate in terms of people thinking actually more about what they want next election for themselves and their families. And obviously that's where, again, that kind of infrastructure argument comes in, because I think more and more people are feeling the pressures of that kind of thing. More and more talk around Auckland particularly, and you get this more in the lead up to Christmas, where people are trying to get places fast, and you face that real congestion on the roads.
It's roads, it's also schools, Trish, and other pressures,
It is absolutely everything, and it's also those big elephants in the room which we don't see. But again, last week or the week before in Auckland, we had 26 beaches closed because they were contaminated. Water and sewage and getting those big systems fixed for Auckland and Wellington in particular, they are a massive elephant in the room.
They are poised for that. They've done the work on that. We've had Nanaia Mahuta sitting in here and hinting that they could well look at a big lending program to councils to do all your three waters type infrastructure, but the quid pro quo would be, or the, we shouldn't use that right now, the deal would be they'd be wanting to deal with a smaller number of bodies. There'd have to be some rationalising of the number of individual organisations you'd been dealing with. They're poised to do that if they're bold enough to get on and do it.
I mean, the budget responsibility rules are an entirely political response to deal with what I see as a highly fairly unfair perception that National's sort of intrinsically better at managing the economy than Labor, when the objective evidence is that we basically had responsible economic management from both parties for some time. In terms of kind of the two aspects of it, I think they could quite easily politically move away from the debt target, explain that interest rates are at historically low levels. You can borrow for 30 years from Swiss banks, can't you, now at less than zero interest rates, and use that for a massive infrastructural transformation of New Zealand. I think that that would definitely work. I'd be more cautious about the deficit because I think that's kind of got some
but that's
sort of
operational spending. Yeah, that's a different funding stream.
And it's unnecessary and inaccurate, but it is still quite symbolic, I think, of budget. I mean, National kind of built up that whole great saga of the fight back from the GFC and Christchurch to finally coming into surplus. You know, that's in people's heads as a sign
of
responsible management.
But this infrastructure stuff would be off that, would be in a different stream in the box. What I'm curious about, though, is your point, Trish, about people starting to think about themselves, understandably, people do, their families, their own financial situations. Are there any votes, and even using the word infrastructure, you know, as it might have some appeal to some in the business sector who have, you know, have had doubts about Labor, and I know they pulled out what was then a very big $1 billion package 15 years ago to deal with Auckland traffic then. Are there votes in it?
Well, I think there are. I mean, there are a couple of things. It depends how you retail it, right? There are a couple of things. One, if you look at the infrastructure projects that require more and more of ratepayers, and if you look at the requirements for trying to unlock greenfields land, particularly around Auckland, where you've still got an argument between council and government about who's going to pay for what, which is slowing things down. I think there are messages there for this government. I do also think that there is, and this is a question for Labor over the holidays, but what are the new thinking big policy platforms that they're going to be able to bring forward next year? And the interesting thing you saw last week with National, with its education paper, they are starting to put that stuff out there already and start to, you know, try and get some stretched thinking and some conversation around these things. And for me, if you're talking about if Labor really wants to come back on that sort of transformational government sort of ambition, these kind of big projects to unlock New Zealand into the future, I think, are
might
really important.
Appeal. Yeah, perhaps with some tax tweaks that we might talk about another time. Education, you mentioned Ballyhark review, and the big thing gone from the initial review with the announcements last week was the idea of these localised hubs that would usurp a lot of the responsibilities of the boards of trustees. And I think we're also going to have a big say in the appointment of principals. What do each of you make about where this has landed, what the appeal is, what the concerns will be?
I think it's what John Key would call a very elegant solution that Chris Hipkins come up with. And I think he deserves considerable credit for where he's landed. I think he's still implementing significant reforms. I think they're reforms underpinned by Labor values and increasing equality, reducing inequality. And probably, you know, if you take the narrow political view, he's avoided a very nasty political fight with the kind of elite Auckland school lobby in election year. So I think it's, a very positive result. I was always bemused when that Ballyhark thing sort of came out of the blue to me anyway. It wasn't sort of, didn't feature in the election, and all of a sudden this is very kind of
it
radical.
It was one of about 150 reviews, I think, Stephen, in working groups.
And this was a really big one,
Hard to keep up with all of them.
And the ferocity of the response, you know, talking about Stalinist solutions and that, was just sort of hot-headed nonsense. But at the same time, it wasn't intuitively clear to me anyway, you know, how those hubs, you know, would automatically lead to, you know, greater equality and educational outcomes. And I think those education support agencies are a lot easier to explain, that you've got the flexibility that if the school's going fine, you know, there's not going to be much involvement. Where it needs help, that help will be provided. And really, I think the politics is down to the zoning.
Yeah. Your take, Trish?
The relief for me is around that regionally based, those advisory support groups, because I think Stephen's hit the nail on the head. The problem that you've got, and where you saw the Auckland school lobby really come out very strongly against this, is because there are some excellent schools, because of obviously the area they sit on and the pool of talent they can draw on for their boards of trustees. There are some fantastic small rural schools who have an excellent board of trustees, but equally, particularly in those areas, you have some very small schools who are absolutely struggling because they just can't access a pool of talent that you need for a board of trustees. And there have been a couple of cases I've heard of this year where schools have gotten into an absolutely terrible mess and they have felt it was almost impossible to access the support they need to try and get help from the ministry to break an impasse around a board of trustees. And I think that will be a relief to those schools, because if you understand those little communities, a rift like that between a board of trustees and a principal and being unable to get help, it can be very, very divisive and corrosive in a community. So I think that will be a relief.
I know the other thing I hear from talking to principals at the time is there's a difference between getting the support they need, which they're crying out for, and being even more heavily bureaucratised by a central bureaucracy, which I can still remember one principal saying is just of a small school and a school with more economic challenges than many, is just a constant nightmare anyway, without wanting to double down on it. So, look, it looks an elegant solution, doesn't it? But the proof is always in the pudding ultimately. Certainly you didn't have the kind of kickback that you had initially. He's had a reasonable run of late, Chris Hipkins, actually, hasn't he? He's sort of quietened down a few.
He's got a massive workload and delivering on it.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks very much. We were going to touch on the referendum. We can do that another time. Let's just say there's going to be a lot of extra politics surrounding the next election, I guess. A lot of lobbying and campaigning on these issues, trying to get into voters' heads as well as the main parties. I think it was Andrew Little who was predicting it could get a bit ugly, but let's pick that up another time. Thanks very much, Stephen Mills and Trish Shewson.